You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 6th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy Phi Day.
Happy Phi Day to you, too, Evan.
Thank you
very
much.
Go Phi yourself.
Yes. Are you missing an R?
P-H-I.
Wait, no, it's Thursday.
Oh.
Oh, Phi Day.
Yes.
And Rebecca will explain the significance of Phi Day. Rebecca,
I would love
to.
Well, today is January...
Today's the 6th, right?
6th. Six.
Yes. And Phi... I don't know. Just tell me. I know three different kinds of Pi days. I know Avogadro's, you know, mole day.
Well, yesterday was... Phi Day, today's Phi Day, tomorrow's Fo
tomorrow's
Day.
Tomorrow's Fo.
Okay, come on. What's Phi Day?
1.618033988. Come on, it's a number
the
we
golden
all
ratio.
Exactly.
Oh, right. Okay, I'm with you now.
Get it, 1.6.
Well, happy that.
Okay.
Happy Phi Day. But actually, I would like to mention something else real quick. It was on January 9th in 1643 that Giovanni Riccioli... I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
He was the guy in the Mod Squad remake.
He was.
A Scientologist.
1643, yes. He noticed something called the Ashen Light of Venus. Have you guys ever heard of that before?
No. The Ashen Light of Venus.
So you know how you can see it when you're looking at the moon, it's like a half moon, and you can still kind of see the dark side of the moon?
Oh, Earthshine. Yes.
Earthshine, right? Well, this is the same equivalent of like Earthshine, only on Venus. And it was the first reported sighting of this shine on the dark half of Venus. But
from Earth?
From Earth, yes.
Wow.
And it was sighted also over the years by other various astronomers throughout time. But it's yet to be definitively discovered that the phenomenon is actually happening because it happens in such a short burst of time. You have to be kind of in this, you know, perfect range to see it. And there are some different competing theories as to exactly what it is. Yeah, some people think it might. Okay. Some scientists think it might be lightning or some other phenomenon. But
interesting. I never heard of that one. Okay,
no, cool. Me either.
Weird.
Better than Phi Day.
Yeah. Well,
one was a backup to the other. I wasn't sure which one, so I throw them both out there.
So the first podcast of the new year, although technically last week's was on January 1st, but that was really our wrap-up episode. This is the first episode of the new year. We traditionally go over predictions, psychic predictions and otherwise, for last year and the next year. So does anyone have any predictions they'd like to, for 2009, they'd like to discuss?
I think that I would like to collect my trophy for being the awesomest predictor of all time on the SGU. For predicting that Michael Jackson would kick it.
You did. You did, in fact, predict that. There were a number of celebrity death predictions on our show last year. Rebecca wins for predicting Michael Jackson.
And I'll say that I only predicted one death.
Yeah, that's true.
That was it.
Michael J. Evan, you predicted Mickey Rooney, who did not die. Jay predicted Britney Spears, who's still alive. And I predicted Ozzy Osbourne, who is still among the living. So we all failed.
Well, I'm changing my vote this year. I'm going to vote for Amy Winehouse.
Oh, that's a good one.
I feel like she's cleaned up her act.
Yeah, I saw her on TV the other day. I didn't notice her. She looked normal. That's why I didn't.
That's meaningless.
I'm going to predict the Reverend Sun Myung Moon.
Why?
Because he's 90.
He'll ascend to godhood finally. Well, even more so.
I'm going with Sylvia Brown. I think that Sylvia Brown is going to have a tragic accident involving a cigarette. She will gasp in surprise when she actually gets a prediction correct, and she will swallow her cigarette.
Ew.
I wonder how that'll sound.
Have you heard her recently?
Oh, man.
She sounds wretched.
Really? I couldn't believe it. I saw her make some predictions on YouTube, and I was just like, wow, if that isn't cancer, I don't know what is.
That's just, she's just trashed her vocal cords.
Oh, you don't mean metaphorically in the way that Sylvia Brown is merely a cancer upon society.
Well, I mean, a little bit, but really, I mean, I've never heard a voice that shot from smoking ever. That was it.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, doing an impression of it actually is not funny enough. Like you can't screw up your voice enough.
You can't do it justice. Well, since we're talking about Sylvia Brown, let's get back to our predictions for 2009. She made some doozies for 2009. She predicted that we could say goodbye to the common cold.
Did that happen yet? Because actually, I think I have it. So, good job.
And here's her reasoning. Many doctors today no longer rush to push patients to take temperature-reducing medications when they come down with fever, unless the fever is dangerous. It's not literally true. They feel the immune system is the patient's best medicine and should be given a chance to fight back, which it does even without a fever. So as the immune system fights a cold with heat, the cure for the common cold certainly may lie in this first signal to heal. So she says, I predict that a small cubicle will become available in doctors' offices sometime in 2009, and it will be heated to a very precise temperature. There may be a special vapor placed into the cubicle. Patients will stand in the cubicle for approximately 5 minutes, and the rhinitis germ will be destroyed. The rhinitis germ.
There's 200 viruses that cause the cold. She's saying there's one?
Yes, the rhinitis germ.
Right.
She saw it on a website and said, that looks awesome.
Or, you know, this is as was told to her by a spirit, so, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, well, they know everything.
There we go. She also predicts that past life regression will become available through a group of trained psychologists on both the East and West Coast of the USA. It'll prove quite a success. Yeah.
She is so crazy.
She's not even trying.
No, she's really not.
She's getting totally lazy.
You know, she can literally say anything, and people will continue to believe her. There's literally no way she can screw up anymore.
So you have to read Mark Edwards' blog post on the Sylvia Shakedown on the Skeptic blog. He went to one of her live sessions, which was hosted by Montel Williams, who is still leeching off of her.
Oh my, what is with that relationship?
Well, he doesn't have a show anymore, but he...
Yeah, nobody else will talk to him.
Yeah, it was a live show on stage, but he was there, on stage with her. And you've got to read Mark's firsthand account of the show, because she's just literally just throwing stuff out off the top of her head, cruel things, and just doesn't care.
But the thing is, I saw Mark's post, and he tried to punk her or something and get up and ask a question where he mentioned the names of some past predictions that went wrong.
The coal miners that she totally blew.
Yeah,
oh,
and
remember
Opal
that?
Joe Jennings. But the thing is, like, I was watching it, and she will never, like, his stunt did nothing. I mean, the audience didn't get it. She didn't care. I don't think she even knew. She just thought he was some crazy person.
She just blew past it.
I guess the Sylvia Brown thing wouldn't be maybe as bad as it is if it weren't for also people like Larry King, who continue to put her on his show and give her airtime that she absolutely does not deserve.
You know, I was thinking about it just now, Ev. You know, of course Montel has her on the show. Of course Larry King does. I mean, they're just feeding each other's popularity, you know?
Yeah. It's a symbiotic relationship. Does anybody have anything else for 2009?
These were my predictions for 2009. An enormous breakthrough in solar energy storage technology. And the capacity to store the harnessed energy will double from 2008's limitations. Not quite, no. Didn't double. But there was an article and a reference in which they made a 7%, I think it came to 7% increase. It went from 31% efficiency to 38% efficiency. Not quite double, but it's kind of a snail's pace of...
That's a typical strategy for these types of predictions. You predict something that is almost guaranteed to happen to some degree, so that you could therefore then claim a victory. Yeah. Like, for example, Billy Meyer claims he predicted that a nuclear accident would happen in France. And the thing is, there's 50 nuclear accidents a year. You know, it's just a matter of what level you're talking about.
Yeah, what's your threshold?
Yeah, it's like saying there's going to be an earthquake. Well, there's earthquakes every year. It's just a matter of how big an earthquake are you talking about. And you can say, yeah, there's going to be some advance in solar technology. You know, you obviously made a more specific prediction, but that's the kind of thing where you could say that, and then you can claim any incremental advance as validating your prediction.
But I tried to predict a few other things, and these were serious predictions. I tapped into my psychic abilities, I think, as best as I possibly could. I predicted 100 new exoplanets would be discovered in 2009.
Well, what was good. The number?
88.
Close.
That's close. I call that a hit.
It's a hit.
I don't know.
That'd be a hit in Sylvia's book, right?
Well, yeah, but if you go by those standards, then everything's
21 would be a hit for her.
Yeah. There's some truthiness about that claim, yeah.
Truthiness.
A long-lost piece of classical music composition by Beethoven will be revealed. I kind of got this right, I think. There was a Mozart piece, actually.
Oh, but that, you retrodicted right. That. That had come out before you made that prediction. Mm-hmm.
No. The Mozart thing came out in February. I predicted in January. And Beethoven's Lost Oboe Concerto was performed.
Ah, that's
the first time.
That's a better pseudo hit, I think, than
that's what you were seeing.
I'll take that.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Next, a heat wave will encompass North America that will send the power grid into rolling blackouts, worse and widespread than the blackouts of August 2003. Well, let's not forget that Brazil had their country's largest blackout in a long time in 2009. I just had to replace the word north with south. My polarities got
mixed. Yeah, you were upside down.
So if I said South America, so I'll take that as a half hit. Let's see. I also said a well-known celebrity will report they've been abducted by extraterrestrials. And that didn't
Couldn't find happen. any match.
I couldn't find anything on that. I said the Cubs will win the World Series. And moving on. shark attack. Here's one. Shark attacks on people will increase by 100% over 2008 totals, leaving scientists baffled.
So what were the totals for 2008 and 2009?
Okay, so 2008, there were 118 reported incidents with 59 confirmed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In 2009, there were 104 reported. Now, we don't have the confirmed number yet. I guess they're still coming back on that. So that's an unofficial.
Right.
So if that reported number holds up, that is almost 100% over the total.
But but the ratio doesn't work. That was a decrease of anything.
Yeah.
Total failure.
Excuse me. Yeah. How about this? Unemployment in the USA will peak at 9.0%.
It went up past 10.
10.2.
You failed.
So that's a hit and then more. One or more Hollywood studios will declare bankruptcy. One major movie studios in Hollywood will declare bankruptcy. Well, MGM was on the verge of bankruptcy. They didn't quite declare it, but they were close in September and October.
So that was a failure.
Well, no, another company called Streamline Studios actually did go bankrupt.
As if you have to say a company called as if we don't know what it is, it's not a major company that...
I'll call that a hit,
too.
Moving on.
Evan, how many predictions did you, in fact, make?
Yeah, well, there's a couple more.
These were all the ones that you made? You're not cherry-picking?
Yeah, for God's sakes, Evan. I hope you don't make this many this year. We're going to be here all night.
Look, my point is
not
that
I don't...
You can go to Sylvia and get predictions. Power. You can come to me and get some real predictions.
Hey, yours are just as good as any other psychics.
Exactly. That's the point, Steve. Why aren't I charging $700 an hour to talk?
Yeah, why aren't you?
It's a good question. Oh, I have morals. That's right.
her voice is more fun to listen to.
All right, I'll stop now.
Okay.
And, maybe I'll post the rest on the boards.
Or people
can have a laugh.
The street psychic predicted there would be an East Coast tsunami strikes by fall.
Nope. I don't remember that.
Yeah, and that the proof of a second gunman in the Kennedy assassination finally comes forth. Wrong.
In fact, there was more evidence proven tying that Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah, right.
Was the guy, and that Time magazine photo was.
Right.
Did you guys see that picture of JFK on a yacht with a bunch of naked women?
Yes,
that was
a few
hoax.
Weeks ago.
It was.
Yes, that was not JFK.
It was.
Those were naked women.
And the photograph.
They were naked women.
And the photograph was taken in 1967.
It wasn't a boat.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm ready to hear Rebecca's list for 2010.
It's not a list. You know, last year I said one thing and it came true.
Well, what's your one for 2010?
So now I'm very anxious to hear what you have to say.
All right. Is everyone listening?
Yes.
2010. Because, no. True seers call it 2010, not 2010. We don't waste syllables. So in 2010, the British Chiropractic Association will go under.
Oh,
really? Wow.
That is my prediction.
Awesome. Wow, your predictions are really good, Rebecca. Between
Thank you.
Sylvia and that, I like it.
Yes, it's going to happen.
All right. Jay, you have any for us?
Yeah, well, I said Amy Winehouse is going to kick the bucket. That's it.
That's it? That's what you got?
No, I have more.
Let's hear it.
I predict that a lost manuscript from the JFK assassinations will be discovered. It'll be rolled up in the barrel of the weapon that killed JFK, and they'll find it.
Mm-hmm. You'd think they would have looked in there before.
No, apparently they haven't.
Hey, what's in here?
We'll see.
Hey, did it, Did anybody think to look at this gun? No. Weird.
I predict look, that they're going to find here. The summer vacation spot that people that used to live in Atlantis would go to. And that summer vacationing spot was at the tip of the Baja Peninsula. And that place will be called the wonderful city of people that like to swim.
Pacificus?
The Pacificus, yes.
Pacificus Maximus.
My final prediction for 2010 is is that everybody from Canada will move 1 inch to the left.
Okay.
At the same time?
Yes. The whole country will move 1 inch to the left.
Permanently?
It'll happen quickly, and it'll be an overnight thing, and then in the morning no one will even know what happened.
I see.
Except for the people who fell out of their bunk beds.
Bob, you have anything for us?
Yeah, I predict, just one really, I predict that in 2010, dark matter will finally be identified with a high degree of confidence. They'll mm-hmm. finally get a handle on what the hell it is, helping to bolster the supersymmetry hypothesis. So,
supersymmetry.
Cross your fingers. And also, I'll just throw this in, that I predict all of Canada will move, but not an inch, just 1 millimeter. I think the tectonic plate just moves like a fraction of a millimeter, so that it'll move that yeah. much.
The actual country will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, Evan?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of talk about methane gas on Mars, and we're going to find out. This is it. This is the year we make contact with the organic life on Mars. It will be determined.
And how's that going to be determined?
That is the cause. By scientists, of
course. Are there any probes on Mars that are capable of doing that?
Oh, of course. Irrelevant is methane.
Evan, you're basically making the biggest prediction that anyone could possibly make, that there's alien life on a planet in our solar system.
Oh, it's not a prediction. It's a fact.
Okay. That's just letting you know how it's huge that
oh,
is.
Oh, and everyone in Canada will move 1 angstrom up.
Man, poor Canada.
Not to the left or the right, but directly
Canada's on the
away
move,
from
baby.
The center of the Earth.
Yes, it will
We're
thrust
going
upward.
Places.
Oh, I got a few.
You're getting oat
what do you got, Steve?
I got a few. I predict that an Earth-sized exoplanet with liquid water will be discovered about a nearby star. And if not in 2010, then definitely in 2011. So I just doubled my chances.
That's good.
I also predict that the Orbo technology will continue to be a complete fraud throughout 2010.
True Ed.
The Orbo.
I further predict that the SGU will visit Australia late in 2010.
Oh, cool. I hope that comes true. Please, please, please.
My money's on that one.
And I believe that a new species of animal will be discovered somewhere.
Okay.
That's it.
Did you see that crab that looks like a strawberry?
Yes, that was awesome.
That was really cool.
Oh, that is a cool photograph.
That's a funny coincidence. Yes. These strawberries are crunchy. What is this?
What are you talking about? Throw it back. I don't want to eat that. Hey, look.
So next, Rebecca is going to update us on the raging controversy of the G-spot.
I would love to. Well, recently a new study came out of my current home country involving 1,800 British women aged 23 to 83 who were surveyed on whether or not they believe that they have a G-spot. And the thing was, these women are all twins, either identical or fraternal, meaning not identical. The idea being that identical twins should identify the presence of a G-spot in higher percentages than non-identical twins, because the identical twins obviously should share more DNA. This is basically what the study purported. And what they found was that 56% of women claim to have a G-spot, but identical twins weren't, in fact, more likely to share the trait as opposed to the non-identical twins. And because of this, the researchers came out and said, well, that's it. There's probably not a G-spot, which has ignited the whole is there or isn't there a G-spot debate across the blogosphere and I think throughout the science world as well. Because up to this point, it's been up in the air. There have been a number of studies in the past that have suggested that there may be such a thing as a G-spot. There have been a number of studies that have looked at the actual biology, looked at the anatomy to try to find the existence of the G-spot, looked at nerve endings and things like that. This, however, was simply self-reporting. So there were a number of problems in that respect with this study, a lot of things that you could criticize. And so if you ask me, it's in no way the final word on the topic of whether or not there is a G-spot. I personally remain on the fence. I couldn't tell you one way or the other, but I don't think that this study is in any way conclusive. And in fact, I feel that it's significantly flawed, mostly because of the fact that even twins who are sharing, let's say they've got identical genes, their experiences of their own sexuality could vary to such a huge degree that I think that it renders this this reporting useless. If you consider the fact that in order to find a G-spot and know that you have a G-spot, a woman would have to do a significant amount of self-exploring, as well as to perhaps have a lover who was helping her orgasm that way. And unfortunately, we're at a point where there's still a number of women who aren't that comfortable with their bodies and haven't explored their bodies to that extent, and therefore may underreport, if a G-spot exists, they may be underreporting it, and it has nothing to do with your genes. So two identical twins could have completely different sexual experiences that could lead one to believing she has a G-spot and the other to believing she doesn't, even though they have identical anatomy.
Yeah, there's the further points that it's not even clear what the average person thinks a G-spot is. So this survey could be distorted by just different notions about what is a G-spot. And also, it wouldn't account for any epigenetic factors, right? So only purely genetic factors. Their premise is that if it's biological, if the G-spot is biological, then it must be genetic, and therefore we should see a statistical difference with these twin studies. But if it's, let's say it's determined partly by hormone levels in the womb, that would be the same for fraternal and identical twins, and that would not be picked up by this kind of a survey. So there's a lot of assumptions that go into their conclusions, and I agree with you, Rebecca, this absolutely will not end the debate. This is actually a scientific debate I've been following for a while. If you remember, we had Terrence Hines on our show a few years ago, and he did one of the original studies. Now, just for a little bit of background, what the alleged G-spot is a location on the anterior distal wall of the vagina, so just behind the pubic bone, anteriorly, that is supposed to be an especially erogenous zone that can, even in some cases, lead to female ejaculation. However, what Terrence found was that if you look at the vaginal wall and you stained for nerve fibers, you don't see any increase. And you don't see any spot where there's an increased density of nerve endings. Therefore, he concluded, anatomically, there is no G-spot.
I think that the conclusion shouldn't be, therefore, there is no G-spot, but therefore, there is no spot with a denser concentration of nerve endings.
I agree.
Because there's, I think, a very good hypothesis out there that suggests that the base of the clitoris is located near about where people suspect the G-spot is. And some women have a very sensitive clitoris, and therefore stimulating that part of the inside of her vagina could in fact stimulate the clitoris and therefore make her orgasm.
That's right. It's called the clitoral root. And what I learned is that there is something called the clitoro-urethro-vaginal complex. So basically you have the root of the clitoris, which is, as you say, basically right over the spot of the anterior vaginal wall where the G-spot is supposed to be. And also there are other studies which show that part of the vagina, basically the anterior and distal part, does have generally more innervation, more nerve endings than other parts of the vaginal wall. So it may be more sensitive generally. And in those women who you maybe have especially sensitive, and again, they're talking about half of women, right, not a small minority, that you actually can get sufficient clitoral stimulation through the vaginal wall. And as you say, that actually functionally is what the G-spot is. I also came across another very intriguing possibility, and that is that the G-spot may correspond to what's known as the vaginal pacemaker. There was a study that did an electrovaginogram. They basically looked at the electrical activity of the muscles in the vagina wall, and they found that there was a baseline activity and that it was increased with any kind of pressure. For example, with penetration during coitus, that would create pressure on the vaginal wall, and that would increase the activity of the vaginal pacemaker, leading to further contractions and engorgement and arousal, and therefore that even though there weren't increased density of nerve fibers, there were a different sort of physiological function of those nerve fibers, and that could explain the G-spot. So a lot of different possibilities that need to be worked out. There actually is not that much research published that I found here. I think I came across just 40 different studies, so you could actually read them all. And those are the most intriguing ideas that have been proposed so far. So I think it's way too premature to conclude there isn't a G-spot, and there's lots of avenues of research to pursue.
I think that the one other thing worth mentioning is that, of course, I don't think that you can ever dismiss the idea of a G-spot, through scientific evaluation, say, well, there's nothing there, because you have half of women reporting that something is happening there. So by discounting biological factors, you can still fall back on a psychological factor and consider that women and many men, of course, can make themselves orgasm just by thinking hard enough about it, by fantasizing, by dreaming.
Yeah.
And so if you have women who believe that this spot is a special spot that's going to make them orgasm, it can, in fact, make them orgasm just through them thinking that, kind of a orgasmic placebo effect. So I think that the important thing is to remember that no matter what is concluded, biologically speaking, I don't think that anybody should discount the experiences of 50 or so percent of women who are reporting that this exists.
Yeah, and that's important. We have to separate the questions of what the G-spot is sexually and functionally from what is it anatomically and physiologically.
Steve, what about a physiological correlate between the thickness of the vaginal wall and the ability to orgasm purely through coital penetration?
Well, there was, I think two studies bear upon that. The vaginal pacemaker one, because again, coital penetration would produce activity in the electrical activity in the vaginal wall. But the other one actually correlated the thickness of the vaginal wall with the ability to have an orgasm. And that shows, I think, almost more than any other study, that there is an anatomical dimension to vaginal orgasm.
Good question, Jay.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
I was going to ask that exact question.
Bob, you're going to tell us about a new type of stellar companion.
I'm calling this one the Kepler conundrum. Yet again, scientists are completely baffled, and actually they really are. They really are kind of scratching their head on this one. This is truly kind of a bizarre enigma. I can't wait to see how this pans out.
Is it wrapped in a riddle?
Yeah, an enigma wrapped in a riddle, all encased
cradled
in a mystery.
Cradled delicately in a mystery.
The mystery is the discovery of two planet-sized objects that are hotter than the stars they orbit. Imagine that. Now, this started with Kepler Observatory. You guys remember that? That was an observatory launched in March of this past year, 2009.
Yeah.
And basically what it's doing, it's monitoring the light from more than 100,000 stars. One website said 150,000 stars. At the same time, it's just looking at the light coming from these stars, looking for dips in brightness. Now, this is called the transit method of detecting planets. The planet basically orbits in front of the star, between us and the star, and of course, the brightness goes down a bit, and from that little dip in brightness, the scientists can figure out lots of things about the object that is orbiting that sun. And the Kepler Observatory is actually the first one that's got a serious chance of detecting the coveted Earth-sized planets that we know must be out there. But so what they're detecting now are primarily what's called hot Jupiters. I'm sure you guys have heard of that.
Yeah.
In fact, it's all over the news today. Kepler is announcing where the team is announcing that they found five new hot Jupiters discovered by Kepler just very recently. Now, hot Jupiters, if you're not aware, they're basically big gas giant planets, you know, Jupiter size, Neptune size, that orbit insanely close to their suns, something like 0.1 AU, or about a million miles away. Now, for comparison, Mercury is 36 million miles away from the sun. So these are just huge planets, super close to their stars. So these latest two discoveries, though, are really crazy because they look like they're hot Jupiters at first. You know, they've got masses similar to Jupiter and Neptune. Their orbital periods are really tiny. Like, one of them was 23 days, and the other one was 5 days. I couldn't find out what their distance from the parent stars were, but I assume that they're very close if they've got an orbital period. So the weirdness started, though, when these objects, whatever they are, went behind the parent stars. Now, nothing should have changed, right? If you're looking at the light the sun is putting out, and you're watching Venus, and Venus goes behind the sun, what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. Really, essentially nothing. Really.
Again, well, there's a tiny dip. You know, that's what Kepler's detecting, but it's tiny.
No, I'm talking behind.
Yeah,
behind.
There's a tiny dip because the planet's no longer reflecting light from the sun.
Right, exactly.
So there's a smaller dip when it goes
behind
and a bigger dip when it transits in front, but they're tiny.
Yeah, that's cool. I didn't actually think it was quite sensitive enough to detect the dip going behind. So that's cool that it's even that sensitive. But this guy looked at the light curve. His name was Jason Rowe. He's a postdoctoral student. He looked at the light curve when this object went behind the planet, and the light from the system dropped by a huge amount. Now, that should not happen. That's just something that's completely unexpected. Why? Why would the light dip by a huge amount? That means that most of the light is coming from this object. So it turned out, I guess they did a little bit more examination of these objects, and they found out that this object is 70,000 degrees Fahrenheit, or 39,000 degrees Celsius. The parent star is only 9,000 degrees Celsius. So, hello, what is going on there? That's insane. It's so interesting. This other object, now this is the second planet around a completely separate star. This also was very, very, very hot, about 14,000 degrees Celsius. I could not find out how hot its sun was, but I'm sure it probably is hotter than its sun as well. Something bizarre is going on here. So what are these things? Basically, the astronomers are saying. Now, the names they're calling them are pretty funny. The Kepler team calls them objects of interest, which I thought was pretty funny. You know, whenever somebody murders their wife, they say the husband is a person of interest.
Person of interest.
I'm sure that's what they kind of were going for there. But even better, Jason Rowe said that he calls them hot companions, which I thought was even funnier. So the theories. What theories are they throwing around here? Jason thinks that these guys are young planets. They're very young, maybe a couple hundred million years old. Young planets are basically molten generally, so they're pretty hot. But I think Jason's nuts. Even assuming tidal effects from the parent star heating the cores, I think these objects are just way too hot to be just young planets. The hottest exoplanet we found so far is only 2,000 degrees Celsius. So this guy's 17,000. I don't think that's going to buy it.
Yeah, don't you need some kind of a fusion going on in order to generate those kind of temperatures? Or I guess that's the big question, right?
I guess that's the question.
But these things are too small for stellar fusion.
Right, and maybe I didn't say it. I guess they determined their sizes or masses roughly to be Jupiter and Neptune size. So that's pretty much confirmed as well. Right. So these aren't just really other normal stars. These are tiny objects that are producing a tremendous amount of heat. The other theory that they're going with is that it's a white dwarf. There's actually a white dwarf star that moved close to its primary star, causing the dwarf to lose its mass to the star. You can kind of see the mass somehow leaching away from the white dwarf. And then this, of course, would reduce the mass and therefore the gravity of the white dwarf, causing it to puff out to Jupiter size. That sounds like a much better theory to me, although it still smells a little bit funny because, you know, why would the star steal mass from the white dwarf? I would think that the white dwarf would more likely steal mass from the star.
Doesn't that kind of make more sense? And then it turns into a 1A supernova.
Right, yeah, it's more complicated than that. Generally, it doesn't happen like that. Usually, it's a white dwarf next to a red giant. But it can theoretically happen with a white dwarf next to a main sequence star, which is what is happening here. So I'm not sure why this wouldn't happen. see, that doesn't sound right to me either. So I'm going to go with option three. This is obviously my favorite, that scientists have come across a new class of celestial object that we just don't know what it is yet. And hopefully this year, maybe I should have made that prediction, this year we'll get a much better beat on exactly what's going on here. I thought it was a fascinating story.
Or option four, it's a power generator for an alien civilization.
I thought of that, but that's very wasteful.
Oh, Bob, when you can generate that kind of energy, you can afford to waste a little bit.
Right. So cool. Keep your keep on the lookout for this. This is, I can't wait to get more details.
Yeah, definitely one to follow. Well, it's a new year, and we do like to mix things up with the new year, so we are going to change the format up a bit. We are going to do Who's That Noisy after the news section of the show and before the listener question section. So, Evan, can you please remind us of Who's That Noisy from 2 weeks ago?
Absolutely. Here you are. That is the club-winged mannequin making that noise with its wings, not with its vocal cords. That kind of violin screeching, you'd think, you know, it's chirping or no. With its wings, in fact.
Cool. Aren't birds cool?
I guess.
Ever since I've started doing Who's That Noisy, they've become so much cooler.
I lost interest in them after terror birds became extinct.
Now, here's what's even cooler. On the message boards, Microraptor guessed correct, was the first to guess correctly, and that was their first post on our message.
Ever.
Wow.
That's right.
Post number one.
They should just retire right now.
That's awesome.
Welcome to the boards, Microraptor, and congratulations for being first.
Well, what do you got for this week, Evan?
All right. Well, for this week, something a little bit different.
Right. It better be good, all right?
It will be good, I promise you. Have I ever failed you? Only a few times. Here we go.
And in a moment, we're going to apply a light to the top, and you should see some light forming. Okay, thank you. Just in case you missed that one, we'll try a slightly bigger one. If we have the lights down, please.
Okay, so you need to guess the noise that you hear in that clip. You don't have to worry about who the voice and the presenter. I want you to tell us, what is that noise occurring in the clip? It occurred twice.
Yeah.
So send in your guesses, and good luck to everybody.
Thank you, Evan.
You're welcome.
We have time for one question this week. This one comes from Jeff Champagne from Boston, Massachusetts. And Jeff writes, I was listening to a very old podcast going through the backlogs, and you were talking about the percentage of our brain that we use. Got me thinking about how much that really is in terms of today's data storage. How many gigabytes or even terabytes can the human brain hold? I have seen some figures online, but none are consistent, ranging from 2 to the 10 billionth to 10 to the 13th. Other figures stating 1 to 1,000 terabytes. The range seems a little too wide to me, and I was hoping you could shed some light on it for me. I apologize if this has ever been brought up on the podcast before, but I still have about 100 to listen to. Again, keep up the good work. Best podcast ever. And Rebecca, Boston seems a little colder this winter.
Oh. That's because of global climate change, but thank you.
Right. So, this is an interesting question. What's the storage of the brain? The short answer is there is no short answer. There is no real answer to that question, because the brain just doesn't store information the same way that computers does, and you can't really translate it into bytes.
Yeah.
But I'll give you some stats to give you an idea what we're dealing with. Does anybody know how many neurons there are in the brain?
24,000 trillion.
Seven, at least.
I knew this.
100 billion.
100 billion, or anywhere from 50 to 200 billion.
And that was 100 trillion connections, though, right?
That was a legitimate
trillion?
Guess. I did not look that up.
But about 100 billion. And I remember that because it's about the same as the number of stars in the Milky Way galaxy.
Yeah, it's the Milky Way galaxy. Yeah.
Couple hundred billion.
Coincidence? I think not.
maybe the Milky Way is one giant brain.
That thinks very slowly.
Each neuron interfaces with 1,000 to 100,000 other neurons through about 100 trillion connections.
Per
That number I remembered. I remember that
wait
number.
Wait a minute.
100 trillion.
Trillion connections total.
Total,
okay.
Yeah. Or more. I mean, that's at the low end. Or it could even be as high as 10 quadrillion synaptic junctions.
Really?
Yeah.
10 quadrillion.
So, I never heard a number that high. Wow.
That's a lot. And
11
quadrillion.
Yeah. You have to understand that one neuron can participate in a lot of different patterns and networks and connections. Mm-hmm. And also what we're learning is that the astrocytes, the other kind of cells in the brain, not the neurons, also participate in the information storage aspect of the brain. They're not just...
Is that like a glial cell? Is that an astrocyte?
Yeah, the glial cells are like the support cells of the brain, and we thought that that's all they were doing was just keeping the neurons alive, but it turns out they actually participate, you know, in information modulation and storage, and therefore it's hard to put a figure on exactly how much information storage there is. The brain's massively parallel, and it's more analog than digital, so you can't say, but we're... That's why it depends on what assumptions you make and how you translate it. That's why you can come up with things like 1 terabyte to 1,000 terabytes. It's such a huge difference. It just depends on how you extrapolate from those raw numbers. So that's the ballpark that we're in. Well, let's go on to our interview. We have a very interesting interview with DJ Grothy, the new president of the JREF. Let's hear what he has to say. Joining us now is DJ Grothy. DJ, welcome back to the Skeptics Guide.
Well, thank you, Steve. How are you?
Great. And a happy new year.
Well, thank you.
So DJ Grothy is the host, or has been the host, of a very popular skeptical podcast, Point of Inquiry, and also a magician who still perform as a magician. Is that correct?
Yeah, I still occasionally perform. I've been really busy the past couple years, but number of shows a year. It's fun.
As well as the program director at the Center for Inquiry and an associate editor of Free Inquiry magazine. But he is joining us at the beginning of the year because DJ has just taken over the position as the new president of the James Randi Educational Foundation. So congratulations on your appointment.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and it's a very exciting time. Just kind of officially started at the beginning of the year, and we're talking as I'm in Fort Lauderdale for the second time, and we're kind of getting things underway. New directions for the foundation. We're very excited.
So why don't you start by just telling us how this all came about? How did you get to be the president of the JREF?
Well, I conspired over many years and plotted and planned, and it paid off. No, honestly, I was approached by the board of the JREF completely out of the blue, and it surprised me, and it surprised everyone else at CFI. You know, I've always been kind of a partisan loyalist to the Center for Inquiry, whose values are my values. I really care about its mission. And so I never really thought about leaving the organization. When a board member of the JREF contacted me, he very appropriately said, "Are you interested in even having a conversation about this possibility?" And I said, "I don't know, let me get back to you." In other words, it wasn't even a yes, let's agree to have a conversation about a possibility. It was, "I don't even really know right now about having the conversation." So the first thing I had to do was then go to my colleagues at CFI, other members of the management committee, because like at a lot of nonprofits and for-profit corporations, there are non-compete clauses and kind of legal strictures that keep you from looking into employment elsewhere and all that stuff. And I got, call it special dispensation from the management of CFI, at least to explore the possibility, because they reasoned, and they were right, that it's the best thing for the movement at large for us not to hike our leg and mark our territory, but for us to continue imagining working together more closely going forward.
That's great. And this is typically what we see happen, is that somebody who's talented and doing a great job at kind of a mid-level management position gets promoted and head up another organization. That happens all the time. It's actually quite natural, isn't it?
I think it is. You look at the history of and kind of the organizational charts, you know, it's the same players in the management of all these nonprofits, and they move around and they all kind of work together and they're rolling up their sleeves, working maybe for GLAAD for a while, and then maybe the Human Rights Campaign or GLSEN or whatever. You know, they care about the issues, and then they find the right organizations that can best use their talents, their human resources for a given period of time. So I was most recently at the Center for Inquiry. I was vice president and director of outreach programs. I oversaw all the Centers for Inquiry, the growing Centers for Inquiry all over North America, and also oversaw our campus outreach program. My experience there, I think, kind of made me a valuable prospect for the JREF, because that skill set that one learns doing that over many years is exactly the kind of thing that JREF needs in leadership. So I was deeply honored. I was gratified to even be considered. And now I'm just thrilled to actually be at the helm. James Randi has been a hero of mine since I was a teenager, first getting into magic. I knew of him as a magician before I ever knew of him as a skeptic. And now to be at the organization that bears his name, you know, it's a really exciting time for me and my family. And I think it's an exciting time. Well, you know, for a lot of my friends, they're like, wow, this is exciting. We can't wait to see what happens.
And just let's get some logistical stuff out of the way, because I know our listeners want to have a lot of questions and want to know what's going on. What is going to happen to Point of Inquiry?
Point of Inquiry, while I've been the host for 4 years, is not my show per se. It's the Center for Inquiry's property. And so we're considering ways that I might continue to host Point of Inquiry. I've offered to continue to host gratis, but it may be in CFI's best interests for them not to have the president of another nonprofit hosting its show. So we think we'll probably, at the JREF, start a new interview show. I'm gratified a lot of people enjoy the conversations I've had with, you know, all these smarty pants over the last 4 years.
Right.
So we may continue it under the auspices of the JREF, a new show. We're thinking it's going to be called For Good Reason.
Oh, I like it.
Yeah, well, thank you. You said that just like we rehearsed. Good.
First take.
If your listeners love these interviews, they can look for that show in the next couple weeks.
Oh, great.
Excellent.
And you don't know what CFI is going to do with Point of Inquiry, but you assume they're just going to have somebody else take over?
I would really hope that they do, because it's developed quite a listenership, and I think the format was unique. It's, to my knowledge, the only long-format interview show of its kind. I mean, Skeptic's Guide does interviews, and other shows do interviews, but, you know, being able to dig down and do an hour-long conversation with a Nobel Prize winner and, you know, even have convivial fisticuffs, if you can imagine that category of fisticuffs, you know, it's a lot of fun.
Right. So what are your big plans for the JREF?
Well, there's let me count the ways, right? there's a lot going on. There's a lot to do with the JREF. What I'm most excited about is educational outreach to school children. So we're launching an initiative called JREF in the Classroom, and we want to resource what we hope will become a network of high school and junior high school teachers affiliated with the JREF who work with us to advance critical thinking and science education in their classrooms. Now, it's not enough just to say science is good, let's talk science education. We want instead to use the investigation of the paranormal, pseudoscience, fringe science claims, quackery, as a means to explore and kind of inculcate in these school kids appreciation for the methods of science and the content of science. So that's one initiative that's really exciting us. I'm excited also about the JREF focusing more on grassroots skeptical outreach and not just being the organization that puts on the coolest conference a year. You know, our amazing meetings are the largest meetings of their kind in the world, but we want to do more than that. We want to do regional conferences. We want to provide resources to local grassroots groups to help them better impact their regions for skepticism and critical thinking. So there are things like that. In other words, at the JREF, we're not going to reinvent the wheel. We're just going to extend the kinds of stuff we're already doing. And we have a great team at the JREF. I'm excited. I think we have what it takes to be able to achieve these kinds of goals.
DJ, any change to the $1 Million Challenge?
Yes, but in a good way. I think some people are concerned about whether or not it will go away. I think that's a jewel in our crown. It's not going to go away. How is it going to change? Well, we're going to invest more of our promotion and more of kind of our intellectual real estate in it. We're going to make more hay out of it. Right now, unfortunately, I can't talk a lot about a lot of the details because we're going to, with great fanfare, make a big announcement in the coming weeks about how we're hoping to breathe some new life into that. It's been really one of our chief means of raising awareness among the public about both the kinds of untested and, I think, irresponsible claims that paranormalists and supernaturalists and quacks and others make, but it's also been a great way that we emphasize to the gullible public, don't be so gullible. Look, if these guys can't win $1 million we have on the table waiting for them, are they going to do what they say they're going to do for you?
I agree. I mean, the million-dollar challenge is iconic in the skeptical movement. It has an absolutely tremendous rhetorical value. And I think we all, you know, although the idea was entertained about dropping it previously, we sort of understood logistically why that may make sense, but everyone, I think, was disappointed that it came to that. So we're happy to hear that, you know, its place in the skeptical movement is recognized and will go forward in some fashion.
Right, and I like that you called it kind of, you talked about its rhetorical power. It is a legitimate challenge, but we should concede that it's not conducting a scientific experiment. We are challenging people to show that what they say is true, right? But we're not scientists conducting scientific experiments. Instead, we're challenging people to put up or shut up. There's a certain PR aspect to it, in other words. But more than that, it's just a great way to give people the opportunity to change the world with their paranormal abilities. Imagine someone winning this $1 million. They'll be world famous. I don't even think we would have egg on our face because I would love to give the $1 million to someone who proves he or she has psychic abilities or whatever paranormal claim. That would change the world. It'd change physics as we know it. It'd change psychology. It'd change our understanding of the universe. And we're willing to put $1 million on the table to do that if anyone can just come up with the evidence to support their claim.
Yeah, that's a really good point. If anyone genuinely won the $1 million, it'd be worth it. I mean, it would be the discovery of the century, to put it mildly.
You know, studying it, people would win Nobel Prizes over the thing. You know, if the JREF were somehow involved in proving that there was such a thing as psychic powers, I would be all for that. It just so happens in decades of looking into this in a fair-minded and open-minded way, we just haven't found the evidence. We're putting up the money in order to incite people, to inspire people to give us the best evidence.
Right, exactly. And also, I mean, let's be honest, too, part of the purpose is to flush out frauds.
Sure, sure. Fraud might be a strong word for some of our claimants because I think some of them are just as sincere as my grandmother when she prays to Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, they're
just
completely sincere. They're sweet hearts. They care about people, and they think they're real, and it just so happens that, oh, wouldn't you know it, the day they tried out for our $1 million, they had a bad day. Well, aw shucks, isn't that a shame?
Yeah.
But they're not all frauds. That's my point now.
Sure.
But yes, we love the exposure that the $1 million challenge gives to claimants wherever they're coming from, whether they have suspicious motives or whether they're, you know, as sincere as my grandma.
Mm-hmm.
The $1 million challenge really is the opportunity for all of them to get exposure if they want it, to win our $1 million to prove that they have these paranormal, supernatural abilities.
DJ, I'm going to pass along a question that we've been hearing. It's coming from the CFI, whose mission sort of combines humanism and skepticism. There are those who wonder, is DJ going to change at all the mission of the JREF to also include either humanism or atheism, or is it going to remain primarily dedicated to scientific skepticism?
The JREF will always have as its primary focus scientific skepticism. It is true that I'm a big old atheist, right? I'm what I would consider an equal opportunity skeptic. I'm a skeptic of ghosts and of the Holy Ghost, fine. But the JREF, I think, has a unique role to play in focusing on, call it the classical questions in organized skepticism. You know, so ghosts and UFOs and cryptozoology, the things that go bump in the night, psychic powers, quacks, frauds, that sort of stuff. Now, I am persuaded personally that the God question, as it's sometimes framed, is a scientific claim. And so, on occasion, I can imagine addressing some religious questions. But that is not the focus of the JREF, and I don't think it will ever be the focus of the JREF. Just a few days ago, I was speaking to a significant supporter of the foundation, and she is religious. And, you know, religious means different things to different people. It could mean, like, weak deist, or, you know, you don't believe in the fundamentalism, but you believe there's something out there. Well, this woman is religious. She is a devout believer in the salvific power of Jesus, right? But she's a supporter of the JREF because she sees the JREF as the organization that's really promoting critical thinking in a culture that is so anti-critical thinking. And so even religious people can say, I'm really behind the mission and the values of the JREF because it's not about sticking it to me over my religion. It's about advancing critical thinking.
Excellent.
Well, it's the new year, and it's never too early to start promoting the amazing meeting 8, which is coming up in July. What have you got planned for us this year?
Eight.
And can you, is it too early to tell us anything about it?
It's too early to tell you the really exciting things, which is kind of a bummer because I'm really excited about those things, right? I'm finalizing some big news. But if people have already been to TAM, the amazing meeting, before, you can imagine more of the same and better, underscore better. Now, that's an audacious claim, because if you've been to any of these amazing meetings in the past, that's almost like a paranormal challenge right there, you know, that we're going to outdo the success of the previous TAMs, the largest convention of its kind in the world. But we have some big names. We have some new kinds of offerings. We're expanding what's been successful in the past. So I could tell you specifically, we're going to try to have some more workshops, really some exciting topics. You know, I guess I'm debating with myself because one of them is really exciting, but I just decided not to mention it. People should look on the website in the next week or 10 days when we think we'll be able to have enough of it finalized to start taking registrations and promoting it. Oh, what the hell? I guess I'll talk about some of the. Oh no, I won't. Never mind. So call me a
strike.
Oh,
what? We lost him.
You guys. But.
And we lost him, Steve.
Talk about a roller coaster ride.
We had you on the hook, and you wiggled away.
It sounds like every first date I've ever had.
So, but as soon as the information is available, we'll be sure to be talking about it on the show.
Oh yeah.
Well, okay. One thing I guess we could talk about is that we're going to only because it involves you, Steve, and others. We're going to expand our offerings about scientific medicine. So that's an easy thing we could talk about. We're not letting the cat out of the bag.
We were chatting offline before we started that we're going to bring back the Science-Based Medicine Conference, but in the form of two workshops. But there will be Science-Based Medicine content at TAM 8.
That kind of emphasizes the JREF's commitment to advancing scientific medicine, science-based medicine, while also offering an authoritative counter to all the quacks out there, but not just quacks, also just spokespeople, people who aren't necessarily charlatans, but people who are just beguiled themselves and are propagandists for the nonsense. So the JREF wants to have more of a focus on those issues, and so we're making more time in the schedule at this year's TAM to focus on that.
DJ, are you moving to Florida?
I am not at this time moving to Florida. My spouse is in law school in St. Louis, and so he's going to be finishing up there. And for the time being, I'm going to kind of manage the foundation's operations remotely. I'll be spending a lot of time in Florida. Like I'm here now, I spent sometime last month here. Later this month, I'm going to be back in Florida. So I'll be spending a lot of time at the foundation, but my home base will be in St. Louis, which, by the way, I love. I'm from St. Louis originally. My grandmother, my parents are there. So I'm looking forward to spending some more time in St. Louis before we make a move somewhere else.
And go Rams. 1-15. That's another topic. Right.
Well, DJ, it's awesome to talk with you, and we're excited about the prospects for the JREF going forward. It sounds like you hit the ground running, and exciting times for the skeptical movement.
Well, thanks, guys. I look forward to talking to you again, and I'll see all of you at TAM. You know, that's another thing it's pretty obvious we should mention. You guys are going to be featured as prominently as ever. I'm hoping even a little more prominently, more opportunities for people to enjoy live Skeptics Guide at this next year's TAM. So that's another thing people could look forward to at the next amazing meeting.
And we're looking forward to it.
Absolutely.
All right. Good night, DJ.
Night.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you later.
Thanks.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is totally bogus. And you all can play along.
I can't say the word bogus in England.
You can't?
You guys might sue me.
And you can't say quack in Holland.
Really?
Apparently.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah, you get sued. Well, there's no theme this week.
Themeless.
Here are the three items. Item number one.
New
research suggests that listening to Mozart helps premature infants grow faster. Item number two, scientists have developed a new method for creating a flu vaccine using insect cells that is significantly faster than existing methods. And item number three, researchers have developed a new drug that promotes the burning of fat instead of carbohydrates for energy, which in mouse studies resulted in significant weight loss. This week we are going to go in reverse order of how well you guys did last year.
Interesting.
That's a good idea.
So Bob,
I thought I'd go last.
Gets to go first.
Ah, go ahead. Call him a bastard. Come on, call him a bastard.
Bob, I did so bad last year that I get to call Steve an hour from now and tell him the answer.
All right, so we got Mozart helped premature baby infants grow fast. I mean, that's just those DVDs and videos were ubiquitous. Have your baby listen to Mozart, and they're going. And everything, they'll be smarter, blah, blah, blah. So now you're saying that there might be something to it. So my knee jerk is like, no way, unless that's what you want me to think. And then a flu vaccine, that would be great if using insect cells instead of a chicken egg, I assume, to create a flu vaccine. That would be awesome. I really hope that's true because I can't believe we still need chicken eggs. And if you're allergic to, say, like chicken proteins and stuff, you can't get those vaccines, so this would be a good advance and faster, which is great because they certainly didn't get the H1 vaccine out as fast as they had promised. I hope that's true. Now we got this drug to promote burning of fat instead of carbohydrates for energy. That's actually that sounds too good to be true. I don't think that that's actually been done. I'm going to say that that is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca.
That seems fishy to me only because I don't understand how it would work, because carbohydrates, if you're not burning the carbs, you burn the fat and then the carbs turn into fat. So you've done nothing. The idea is to burn off your carbs first and then you start burning fat anyway. So that doesn't really make sense to me. I do think that the listening to Mozart helping premature infants grow faster is something you totally threw in because you knew we would call BS on it immediately. But the Mozart effect that has been thoroughly debunkified is the one that suggests that playing Mozart, I think, like while the baby is still in the womb or something, or maybe while they're just after they've been born. But anyway, it's supposed to increase their intelligence, and that's been proven to be complete nonsense. But helping premature infants grow faster, I bet it's not to do with Mozart so much as like music,
auditory processing,
or the tempo or something like
that.
And we know that they've been looking for a new way to make flu vaccines for a while because the chicken egg thing is It just takes way too long. So I'm going to side with my co-rogue there and say that a new drug that promotes the burning of fat instead of carbs does not exist.
All right, Evan?
The Mozart one, I totally agree with Rebecca and Bob's take on that. You know, and why Mozart? You know, it is probably any kind of music. And yes, you're trying to trick us on the whole Mozart effect thing. So that's science. The flu vaccine, yes, that is science too. And all that leaves is these mouse studies. And that one must be fiction because any studies conducted by mice have been proven to be false. Thank you.
All right. And that leaves us with Jay.
Well, I mean, how can I not?
The gravity right, is so great right now. You must
come
be sucked
on,
into
Jay.
It.
Yeah, people. My initial reaction about the listening to Mozart to do anything other than just enjoy the music, my knee-jerk reaction is that's crap. But I like what everyone said about that, so I can't really argue against that. The whole thing about the flu vaccines and using insect cells, say it isn't so. I don't want to have anything to do with parasites and insects and all that stuff. Like, come on. Can't be taking our vaccines from freaking these eggs that are going to grow aliens out of our spine sacs and all that stuff. Like, forget about
spine
it.
Spine sac aliens.
Did Jay just lose his mind?
No, do you remember Steve said we have a sac of fluid at the base of our spine? No! Why?
Because.
You also have a sac of fluid at the back of your knee.
Really? Yes,
on the back side of your knee.
Well, synovial fluid?
I know where else you have a sac of fluid.
So, this new drug that they say that promotes the burning of fat instead of carbohydrate, I can't see how that could possibly be real. That just seems like total BS to me. So I will pick that one as well, even though I don't quite agree with everyone's analysis. I choose that one.
So we'll just take a moon order since you guys all agree. Item number one, new research suggests that listening to Mozart helps premature infants grow faster. That one is science.
Yeah. Is it actually Mozart, though?
Yes, very surprising. And yeah, you are correct. The quote-unquote Mozart effect, that listening to Mozart will improve cognitive function, is bogus. That is not real, despite the fact that it spawned an entire industry. But what this study is looking at is using music like Mozart. They did use Mozart for the study, although I doubt that it's specific to Mozart. Does help premature infants grow faster. That actually has been previously shown, and what the new study suggests is the mechanism by which that happens. What do you guys think about that?
Well, something gets stimulated in the brain, causing the secretion of something that helps generate growth.
No, it's quite the opposite. The music is relaxing, and that reduces the baby's baseline energy expenditure, so they have more calories left for growing.
Interesting.
It's that simple.
You think they would have wanted to start their own niche, though, maybe try Beethoven or something, just to separate themselves
right.
from the quackery
Bob.
Of the Mozart
right?
effect.
Exactly, because only people are going to see Mozart and they're going to think Mozart effect, right?
I mean, but they're playing off like a second Mozart effect. They're actually trying to piggyback on the Mozart effect.
Yeah, this is the real Mozart
effect. Okay,
right.
And everyone will forget the other one. I get it.
They should call it the Amadeus effect or something.
I taught my baby to talk before they were born.
Rock me Amadeus.
All right, item number two. Scientists have developed a new method for creating a flu vaccine using insect cells that is significantly faster than existing methods, and that one
please,
also science.
Yay! What insect?
That's
and they,
awesome.
Jay, they have to incubate the insect cells in a parasite, and then they have to inject it into an aborted fetus and feed it to aliens.
An aborted insect fetus?
It had to be going up until the aliens.
What did you say, aliens?
It grays? Just to make it as disgusting as possible. No, it's just insect cells. So what they're using is a technique to produce...
A technique?
Technique. Virus-like particles. So they're not producing an intact virus, either alive or dead. They're using virus-like particles without the nucleic acid, so it can't cause an infection. But it has all of the protein stuff on the outside so that it will trigger the immune system. And they say that they can go through this process a lot quicker than the traditional method. They don't have to use chicken eggs. You're right, Bob. That eliminates the problem of some people being allergic to chicken egg proteins. So that won't have that problem. It'll increase the speed or decrease the turnaround time for going from identifying a new strain and producing vaccines. So
Steve, if I have to puke on my food to digest it after I get the next flu vaccine, I'm going to kick your ass.
But you can't.
I hope it's not a praying mantis.
It's funny, Jamie. You can imagine the anti-vaxxers are already going to be, you know, hitting upon this as a way of scaremongering. It's insect cells. Oh, who cares? It's cells.
Even Jay from the Skeptics Guide is afraid. Yeah.
Steve, so Steve, that's huge.
Fly is a documentary.
Yeah, if this pans out, you know, then this could be a huge improvement in the vaccine technology. Absolutely.
Well, how big of an if are we talking, though? Is this the beginnings?
It seems pretty good. It seems pretty solid.
Awesome.
I think, you know, usually these things come down to, can it be industrialized?
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Super large scale.
What if people wind up being allergic to these insects?
Yeah, I doubt it. Okay. I doubt that's going to be an issue.
Which
means that researchers have developed a new drug that promotes the burning of fat instead of carbohydrates for energy, which in mouse studies resulted in significant weight loss, is complete fiction. And you guys were all over this one.
Oh, yeah.
Your reasoning was quite sound.
Like flies on food.
Rebecca, I think you were most on point in that if you do block the burning of carbohydrates in favor of the burning of fat, the carbohydrates just turn right into fat. In fact, what the recent analysis showed, that's exactly what happens. That when you – and they were able to block in mice through – just by blocking pathways, the ability to burn carbohydrates for energy. And this did result in fat burning. But the mice that were given – actually, it wasn't a drug. It was a genetic manipulation. They created a genetic strain of mice that would burn fat instead of carbohydrates. And fed the same diet, it resulted in the same weight. They just turned their carbohydrates into fat. So the researchers concluded that a calorie is a calorie. It's, you know, it still come, their weight still came down to calories in, calories out, and it doesn't matter what pathway the calories get turned into useful energy. At the end of the day, an ATP, which is the energy molecule that our cells use.
Adenosine triphosphate.
That's right. An ATP is an ATP. It's a unit of energy. Doesn't matter how the cell got it. It still works the same.
I love it. It's one of those. It's like this law of the universe, you know, calories in, calories out. And
it's thermodynamics.
I'm so with it,
you know. I mean, yes, there are differences in how many calories you expend in getting the calories out of food, but those differences appear not to be that significant when you actually study it in animals, in whole organisms, is the bottom line. So very good. You guys are starting off the year with a
100%.
With 100%.
Last year.
Right.
It was a clean sweep right out of the gate.
Clean
you know?
Sweep.
That's right.
Clean sweep.
You know what my secret is?
What?
I took a nap. That's right.
Took a nap.
That's
awesome.
Right. It's still 2:30 a.m.
Plus
20 minutes ago
I still
from
have
the
a
show.
Cold.
Plus, copy Bob.
Yes, Bob.
I'm just saying.
You led the way.
That did help.
Oh, boy. You know what I didn't think? I didn't realize that after we get the stats. After Mike revealed the stats from last week, that we have to deal with Bob's ego for the next like month or two, you know.
Bob, yeah, Jay, the next year, all right, until the stats come out for 2010.
Yeah, I'm really working it, aren't I? Woo-hoo, wow, my headphones don't fit anymore. Wow,
Bob, Jay has to criticize you about something, man. He's sitting there at the bottom.
Can we play the Rocky music now as we cue Bob for his...
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah, Jay, think of it in terms of a Rocky movie. You're the underdog.
That's right.
You're going to come back and...
You can work hard, Jay. You can actually read science news items and you can beat Bob this year.
Did you hear that Sylvester Stallone got a hairline fracture on his neck from filming his last movie?
Oh, really?
Yep.
Ooh.
He has like a metal plate in his neck now.
Well, it's, you know, you do stunts like that. Wow. That's what happens.
Was it because his mom was trying to read his butt?
Something about a crowd.
Oh, boy.
Hey, Mom. For new listeners.
That brings me back. Go to episode 37.
Yeah, like that. Episode 20, I think we talked about that.
So this quote is, I stole this quote from Evan, who stole it from Carl Sagan.
Oh, cool.
Evan posted this quote on his Facebook yesterday.
So it's a Carl Sagan quote.
It is.
And then it turned into like a big philosophical discussion with another friend of ours that got pretty deep. But anyway, I just, you know, I realized, though, that the quote was fantastic, and we haven't read it yet, so here
fantastic,
it is.
Fantastic, then.
And this is, of course, by Carl Sagan. In every country, we should be teaching our children the scientific method and the reasons for a Bill of Rights. With it comes a certain decency, humility, and community spirit. In the demon-haunted world that we inhabit, by virtue of being human, this may be all that stands between us and the enveloping darkness. Carl Sagan!
Carl's always good for a quote.
Oh, especially for the first one of the year of 2010.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's a good way to start it off. I should have mentioned this earlier, but I am going to be co-hosting the Little Atoms radio show and podcast, which I mentioned once or twice before on the show. And every time I do, I say Little Atoms, and then people search for a podcast called Little Atoms.
No.
Like ADA. No. That's not it. It's
ATOMS.
Yep. Atoms.
Yeah. It's a London radio show. It's on Resonance 104.4 on Friday nights. And I'm going to be hosting it 1 week per month. And those of you, I guess if you're listening to this week, my first episode should have just gone online at littleatoms.com. I think I'm going to be sitting down with Brian Cox, but I'm not sure yet. It's going to be a mystery. But it's going to be a good time. It's a fun radio show, so very excited.
Also, I'd like to point out that on the Voice of Reason internet radio show, they have initiated a Science Sunday. Every Sunday night, you can live stream and you can listen to several science podcasts and head up by The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. So they start out with The Skeptic's Guide, then they play an episode of Skeptoid, then Are We Alone, and then Astronomy Cast. They put those together as a Science Sunday.
Cool.
On the Voice
of Reason.
That's great. That's fantastic.
Very nice.
There were a lot of people that helped us with the show last year doing a lot of different things, and I thought I'd quickly try to read through the names of the people that gave us some support or donated their time. So on our forums, we actually have a forum community that with a ton of members on there. We actually have a lot of people that help us. So here's the quick list. We have Beleth, The Lost Vertex, Karen, Neutral Milk, Pandemonium, Funda 62, Lee the Agent, Parrish, Stone Quarry, Dave Kidneys, James Tate, Leslie 417, Misfito Joy, Misfit of Joy.
Misfito Joy.
Red Fox.
The Penis Mightier.
Slice and Dice, Jim S., Joel Y., Belgareth, and Skulker. And if we're forgetting anyone, I'm really sorry about that.
And if you want us to say your real names, let us know what they are. We'll say them.
Jake Wilson continued to give us his musical support. We had Jeremy definitely was still on helping us this year. And Fayek and Ricky also donated artwork and T-shirt designs. And I hope we're not forgetting anyone. If we are, just email me and I'll mention you next time. But thank you, everyone, for all your support last year.
We'd like to thank everyone who helped us out at the live events.
We had Courtney and Kristen and Jack help us at our live shows. Mike Lassell gives us more support than anybody.
I've heard of him.
Of course.
Thank you. We have to thank Sid for taking Rebecca off of our hands.
Oh?
Finally.
Oh, thank you, Sid.
We've been trying to get you married for years.
Sid was eating marzipan earlier.
Settle you down.
No, for taking her out of circulation.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Well, yeah, I mean, we're not bothered with all those pesky marriage proposals.
I know. That is true. That is wonderful.
By pesky marriage proposals, I mean awesome marriage proposals.
One quick note, too. Many of you may have noticed that last weekend there were some problems downloading episode 232. It was a problem with our media host. There was nothing we could do about it except nag them until they fixed it, which they eventually did. So if you didn't download episode 232, it is working 100% normally now. Just go back to the website or iTunes or Zune or wherever you get it from, and it should download normally now. Mm-hmm. And also, I will note that in the future, when those technical hiccups occur, you can learn about them by looking at our homepage, and even quicker than that, on the forums. And also, if you follow us on Twitter, I do give updates about the status of new episodes coming out and any delays or anything on Twitter. So follow us on Twitter.
What's our name on Twitter?
It's The Skeptic's Guide. So thanks for joining me again this week, everyone.
Shirley.
Thank you.
2010. Yeah,
yeah. You owe us big time.
That's true, always. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.